Fourth case this morning, Manizak against the International Union of Operating Engineers. Mr. Hernandez.
Good morning, Judge. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Renee Hernandez. I represent the plaintiff and the appellant in this matter, Joanne Romanziak Sanchez, against the Local 150 out of Rockford, Illinois. This matter comes before you because it was dismissed by Judge Reinhart in the Western Division, finding that there was no action here at all. We filed a timely notice of appeal, and in this particular case, we assert that there was indeed a couple bases in which we should have went to trial on this case. The first thing that we assert is that the conduct that was presented in the response to summary judgment on our side, the non-moving party, demonstrated that the conduct in this particular workplace was more severe than the conduct which was found actionable by the Supreme Court in the Harris case. It was continual and repeated. It was made by the people in charge. We're talking about Mr. McCaffrey, Mr. McMillan, Mr. Boyd. All these individuals participate as the business agents. They ran the show in Rockford. Well,
who did they supervise?
They supervised my client directly. She was a secretary.
All the business agents that were in and out of there supervised her?
The main one, as I recall, was Mr. Milliken and then Mr. McCaffrey, with Scott Dahl also having the ability to tell her what to do. These gentlemen were in charge of the Local 150 in the Rockford facility. They ran it. They did all the day-to-day work, and she was the one that was given the work to do on a day-to-day basis by them. She could not tell them no. They were her supervisors. She had to do what they instructed her to do.
Could they fire her?
Did they hire her? My recollection of the facts was Mr. McMillan was, in fact, responsible for my client being hired. He interviewed her. And we believe that the timeline would have been January of 1999. She was hired as a dispatcher secretary for the Local 150. As far as the termination goes, this is another point that we bring up in our appeals, that the individuals that she was complaining to, the very bosses who were engaging in this activity, the foul and offensive and actually perverse language on a day-to-day basis in the workplace, she complained to them as her supervisors. And in response, what they did was held a joint meeting in which they decided to terminate her. They call another guy in another location who does not work in Rockford, does not do any day-to-day supervision, and he just rubber-stamped the termination, and he sent out the local attorney to come and terminate my client. There was never an explanation. And also, one of the key points is, in this particular case, what we have here is zero discipline for my client. Zero. Nothing documented. And the court should take and be well advised to take a look at that, because you see the affidavits all after the fact, all in litigation. Now do all these supervisors come out and say, well, she had this problem, this problem, this problem. But there's not one iota of any written documentation in her work file which supports their propositions, period. If she was such a horrible employee, as they assert, her employee should have been chocked full of good discipline which would support their propositions. The timing stinks, bottom line. Timing stinks. She's complaining to these guys, and they're tired of her complaining about what she's talking about. What she's talking about is a statutorily protected activity. I'm tired of hearing all these words. And, you know, obviously, you have the briefs in front of you. I don't want to digress and repeat this in this forum, but the language is clear. We see the F word. We see the sex acts being described, oral acts, or particular acts of sex that are being done and said. And they acknowledge it. They actually admit that they said those things in her presence. And my client says it was on a day-to-day basis. So we have the hostile work environment. How can that environment not affect that type of conduct, affect anyone?
Back up a minute. Did your client testify or put in an affidavit to the effect that the sexual innuendo was daily, or just the curse words were daily?
What we know is the curse words were daily.
Right,
the sexual innuendo was happening time to time, and you can hear it. Whether it was they even made reference to her husband.
Right, I remember what it was.
And actually, her daughter as well. I mean, this was the boys' locker room, and they ran it the way they saw fit. And when she complained, they finally had enough of her complaints, and out the door she went.
So the evidence is that the sexual innuendo, the locker room talk, was from time to time?
I don't think it can be construed as time to time. I think when you're asking me about specific questions, she was testifying on a day-to-day basis the activities in which the BAs were saying, talking about the oral acts of sex, the anal acts of sex. This was happening all the time. The F word was used pervasively in front of her all the time. Now, specifically as to her husband and her, whether they remarked about her chest or about other women, and the particular Mr. Dahl, his sexual prowess and his ability to do somebody on a table in the local 150, that didn't happen every day, but it was happening. And the point we're trying to make is that she's expressing her concern, she's objecting to it, telling her supervisors, come on, you guys, you got to clean this up, and they're tired of hearing of her. So
the EEOC complaint the court focused on as being based on some kind of ethnic derogation, that talking about her Mexican husband, and that was seemed to be the basis of it. This pervasive, we'll call it locker room talk, although it's a lot more places than locker room, that is commonplace, unfortunately, that went on for 2.5 years. And then occasional, you know, maybe more than occasional references to her, other people. I don't know to what extent she tolerated or participated in it. That's another question. But it does seem that her EEOC complaint is what falls short as extending it to this hostile environment for sexual harassment.
One of the things I'd like to alert the court to is that there were some prior decisions by this court, and I think one of them was the O'Reilly case, and then there was another case of Haugerud. The O'Rourke case, getting my Irish confused, and the Haugerud case. And what we're trying to do is look at whether or not the EEOC complaint or the Illinois Department of Human Rights charge, in fact, invokes the same facts, the same people. And in this particular case, it does. The same facts, the same people, the same timeline, the same conduct. The purpose, I think, and my belief is that the purpose of doing that and providing this information is so that the defendant is not unduly prejudiced by the conduct. And in this case, now that's correct. She went pro se to the EEOC on her belief as to what it was. I would submit to this court that, you know, people need an opportunity to naturally flow from the facts that are discovered from an EEOC charge, because most people don't. Pro se people don't understand what the legal vernacular or the legal prima facie case is for retaliation or sex discrimination. She makes her point. She brings it out. And what I naturally saw when I got involved was retaliation for the expression of her objection to the conduct that was occurring in the workplace. So I think that this is natural that the court should see the same set of facts, same actors, same timeline, as a natural extension of the EEOC complaint. They certainly weren't surprised. It's all the same people, all the same conduct, all the same. There's nothing changed about the conduct. I recognized it as an attorney, but I will submit to this court, there's a lot of attorneys that would not know retaliation in this federal forum.
Counsel, to clarify the record, she made the hostile work environment claim based on sex discrimination allegations in the EEOC. She just did not specify a retaliation claim.
There is no retaliation claim whatsoever. She believed that the reason she was terminated was because of her relationship with her husband, her marriage to her Hispanic husband. And I believe that she believed that because what she had heard from her supervisors referencing she couldn't be married to this guy, and the talk about the ethnic talk about her husband by the supervisors. And I'd ask this court, and which brings brings us to the next point, is to consider this a natural extension and a logical extension of that EEOC complaint. I would like to preserve just a little time for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hernandez. Ms. Colwick.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Alexia Kulwick, and I represent the defendant appellee in this matter, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150. The case before you, Your Honors, is fairly straightforward. After Local 150 terminated the plaintiff, Joanne Romanizak Sanchez, for continued work performance, she filed an EEOC and IDHR charge alleging that Local 150 terminated her for marrying an individual of Mexican descent and her marital status generally. Eventually, she added charges in her EEOC file alleging Local 150 engaged in sexual harassment. At all times before the two agencies, however, she maintained that she was terminated for marrying an individual of Mexican descent and her marital status generally. For the first time in her complaint before the district court, she alleges that Local 150 retaliated against her for complaining of sexual harassment. Your Honors, which I will get to later, the conduct in this case does not arise to the level of harassment, but first, Plaintiff Romanizak Sanchez has several legal burdens that she simply cannot meet. First of all, the district court was correct in finding that Ms. Sanchez waived her retaliation claim. The cases referred to by counsel, O'Rourke versus Continental Casualty, states clearly that a retaliation claim is separate from a claim of discrimination. This court in O'Rourke stated that retaliation is an adverse consequence deliberately attached to the exercise of a right protected by law and is a separate action from discrimination. Discrimination, this court has ruled, is one set of facts. Complaining about that discrimination and an employer retaliating because of that is another set of facts. At no time before the EEOC or IDHR did Sanchez allege that Local 150 retaliated against her, and she therefore waived those claims. The district court correctly found that even had she not waived her claims, Sanchez simply cannot make out a case of retaliation. Under the direct method of proof, it is undisputed that Sanchez has no direct evidence that Local 150 retaliated against her. Sanchez also failed to present any facts or circumstantial evidence from which the trier of fact could infer that Local 150 retaliated against her, and she therefore could not proceed under the direct method of proof. Nor did Sanchez satisfy her burden of proving a prima facie case that Local 150 retaliated against her. Sanchez cannot demonstrate that she satisfied the first factor in proving that prima facie case, that she engaged in protected activity. In Brown versus Chicago Transit Authority, this court emphasized that a party seeking to avoid summary judgment on a retaliation claim may not establish a dispute of material fact based on unsubstantiated assertions, either in affidavit or deposition form. Here, Sanchez makes assertions that she engaged in complaints of sexual harassment at her workplace. Yet she acknowledges receiving Local 150's sexual harassment policy and not filing a complaint under that policy. She acknowledges that her supervisors were B. McManus and Joe Ward, and she did not complain to them of the harassment. She acknowledges that she didn't speak with any of her coworkers, her fellow dispatchers, who she spoke with on a daily basis, who were female and who she was comfortable with. She acknowledged she didn't say anything to them about the alleged harassment. And in fact, the individuals in her office, the business agents she complains of, when questioned at her deposition about whether she complained to them, she answered she would generally laugh off what the guys would say or walk away. When questioned on specific comments, she either answered that she did not complain, she did not recall whether or not she complained, or in a few instances, she told the individual who made the comment that he was, quote, sick or gross. Sanchez simply cannot satisfy her burden of proving that she engaged in any protected activity. Nor can Sanchez satisfy the second requirement of a case of retaliation, that she adequately performed her job. She presents no facts to the district court or this court that demonstrate that she, in fact, adequately performed her job. She criticizes, as counsel says today, Local 150's file regarding her job performance, but she acknowledged receiving a visit from her supervisor, B. McManus, who criticized her work. She acknowledged...
Her supervisor, is it pretty clear that B. McManus is the person who oversees her work, or just... What, answers complaints? She only comes around when there's trouble, I guess she said.
That is exactly what the plaintiff testified to, Your Honor. B. McManus was the head dispatcher until February of 2001. So while her office, she was located in Local 150's District 1 Countryside office, she was in charge of all of the dispatchers, as Sanchez acknowledged. On a day-to-day basis, the business agents could assign Sanchez tasks such as typing or such as taking certain messages, but they did not have any ultimate authority over her. And in fact, all of the agents have provided in deposition or affidavit form that they don't have the authority to hire, fire, promote, or demote an employee.
Who was her on-site supervisor?
According to Sanchez, which we would dispute, Your Honor, she alleges that business agent Mike Milliken and Mark McCaffrey supervised her, which is important to note for the employer liability portion of her charge here, Your Honor. She says before this court that Scott Dahl was the main harasser. So even at worst, presuming that what Sanchez says is correct, as you must, that Mike Milliken and Mark McCaffrey supervised her, that's not the individual that she alleged engaged in this harassment. That was Scott Dahl. And so turning quickly to the employer liability portion of her case, Local 150 has the right under the Supreme Court cases of Farragher versus Boca Raton and Ellerth that Local 150 can, in fact, rely on the policy that it had in place to prevent harassment. And in this case, Sanchez, again, acknowledged receiving that policy. She did not try to file a complaint or speak with anyone under that policy. She acknowledges not trying to complain to those with ultimate authority over her, B. McManus or Joe Ward, or any of the officers in the union for that matter. Sanchez also did not establish under the retaliation claim that there was another similarly situated employee that was treated any differently to her. Quickly turning to her sexual harassment claims, Your Honors, the majority of her claims were time-barred. As this court has stated in Hall versus Bodine in a number of cases, it is the plaintiff's burden to demonstrate that all of the allegations took place in the 300-day charge filing period before the EEOC or IDHR. When questioned at her deposition on these allegations, the majority of them, plaintiff acknowledged, occurred in either October or November of 1999. She alleges a couple of these instances occurred in February and March of 2000, or she states that she doesn't know or can't recall or can't give a specific date of the alleged harassment, with two exceptions. Remember, of course, she was terminated in June 2001, so the majority of these claims simply fall outside the 300 days that she had in which to file her EEOC or IDHR charge.
I guess there's two things here. One, we have this sort of pervasive atmosphere that seems to be almost daily. That's the way everybody talks and jokes and interacts. And then there are specific incidents where she identifies as something, I guess, actionable. And you're saying those specific incidents are outside 300 days, is that?
Right, Your Honor. The specific incidents in which there was reference allegedly to her husband or some of the comments that were more directed at plaintiff, the vast majority of those took place outside the 300 days. As acknowledged, I think, by counsel in his argument here today, the vulgarities, the swearing she alleges occurred on a daily basis, but the specific incidents that are set out in which she is involved in the conversation allegedly occurred, with two exceptions, outside of that 300-day period. As to the things that occurred daily, Your Honors, as this court said in Hall versus Bodine as well, simply saying that something happened on a, quote, continual basis does not satisfy that plaintiff's burden of establishing that the allegations took place in the time filing period. Quickly, also on the issue of timing, Your Honors, the two incidents that did allegedly take place in the 300-day period, when questioned on those, Sanchez acknowledged that she did not complain about those two incidents. Directly, the one comment from the Local 150 member, Bill Wood, that she alleges, she acknowledges not telling anybody about that comment. Bill Wood is not an employee, he is not a supervisor, he is a member of the union, and she didn't tell anyone about it. The only other specific incident that occurred within the 300 days, she alleges took place a month and a half before she was let go. When questioned about whether she had complained of that incident, Sanchez responded that she didn't do anything and she didn't have to say anything. She didn't prove that she complained about this conduct, so turning quickly back to her retaliation claim, contrary to what counsel suggests, there is no timing problem here. The only two incidents allegedly within those 300 days she didn't complain of, and Local 150 did not, in fact, terminate her for complaints that didn't occur. Your Honors, looking at harassment, we'll rely on our briefs. We request that you affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Hernandez? You probably have about 30 seconds.
I would imagine. All right. I disagree with her interpretation as to affidavits and depositions. What you have is direct evidence, which is contrary to their evidence, which is they're presenting. They're relying upon themselves to overcome her. They'll become genuine issues of fact that need to be resolved by the jury. And whether or not the specific incidents were complained about is irrelevant. If she complains, what is this locker room activity and this hostile work environment, that's enough. She's trying to say that she has to be pinpointed to a specific incident, but their conduct, if she complains about it, that's enough. It doesn't take the route that she says. I thank you for your time. I see my time is up, and I appreciate this court's consideration.
The case is taken under advisement.